This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Howard Hessman, the actor best known for playing a radio DJ on WKRP in Cincinnati, died Saturday in Los Angeles due to complications from colon surgery. He was 81. In the 1960s, Hessman performed in the San Francisco improv troupe, The Committee, which regularly performed at anti-war and civil rights demonstrations. He had many minor roles in film and TV, including playing a hippie on Dragnet, before landing the part on WKRP in Cincinnati, which aired from 1978 to 1982 on CBS. Hessman likely drew on his experiences as a San Francisco DJ for the character Johnny Fever.
Cincinnati, it is time for this town to get down. You got Johnny, Dr. Johnny Fever, and I am burning up in here.
What? Hessman was also known for playing the teacher Charlie Moore on the sitcom Head of the Class, which aired from 1986 to 91, and for other roles, including a brief appearance in the rock and roll mockumentary This Is Spinal Tap. He played the manager of a rival band who politely blows off the members of Spinal Tap after they try to chat him up in a hotel lobby.
Where are you playing in Tap? Are you playing here?
We're doing the Enormo Dome, whatever it is. It's terrific.
Oh,
it's
yeah, a big house. Place. Sold that's it out. Of town. That's
very
a big
nice.
Place. You sold
what's
it out.
How's safe?
We really should well, run, you know.
That's good.
Good.
How are you, Letty? Great to see you, Ter. Terrific to see
Liam.
You.
Liam.
Ian.
Yeah. Listen, we'd love to stand around and chat, but we got to... sit down in the lobby and wait for the limo.
Okay. Duke,
we'll
thanks
catch up with
great
you on the road.
See you again, Terry.
Yeah. Cheers.
Best of luck.
Yeah.
Duke, we'll catch up
great.
At your house, maybe.
Great.
Great to see you.
Great.
Yeah.
See ya.
Good days.
See you,
good days.
And in an episode of the TV series ER, Hessman played a man high on drugs found in the middle of the street.
But I'm sitting in the middle of the street directing traffic.
Well, I was just trying to calm the masses. There was so much negative energy that nobody could feel that universal connection that we all have.
Right. What are you on, buddy? What are you on? What are you
oh,
on?
No. You know, when I touch you like this... We are exchanging matter on a subatomic particle
Right, well, I don't
level.
Know where your atoms have been, so it's best that you just keep them to yourself.
Whoa. What's this?
I'm taking an acid trip.
Oh, you would be wrong. LSD is a man-made chemical, and psilocybin is a gift from God.
Oh, the magic of mushrooms.
Yes, that is.
Terry spoke to Howard Hessman in 1988 when he was starring in the sitcom Head of the Class.
Head of the Class is, in a way, a reversal of the type of school shows that television had on, say, in the 1960s, because in this case, the students are the overachievers, and you, as the teacher, is the one who's trying to loosen them up a little bit.
Yeah, I guess that's accurate.
But yet you're the authority figure, which most TV viewers aren't used to seeing you as.
I guess they're not. I don't. I'm not used to seeing myself that way. But you know, when you say it's sort of a reversal of the '60s, so are the '80s in a sickening sense. A reversal of the '60s, in which you know nobody wants to take responsibility for much of anything, but they want all the rewards and accoutrements of a responsible life. Thus, the planet is sort of slowly dying off.
When...
at least that's my sort of pinhead view this morning.
What are the parts of the character that you think of as yours? Character dimensions that you added that weren't in the way the character was initially conceived?
Well, in television particularly, where everything is done in such a, I don't want to say a shorthand manner, but a shortcut manner, actors have a... that actors sort of are the character. It's not as though you're given a well-delineated character that's been tried and tested over a period of time, like, you know, stage characters, or someone who's a character that's had the benefit of a long period of development, of gestation and development in the writer's mind. The character is created, and once it's sold, there is this enormous rush to make things work in a very tight time schedule with as tight a budget as possible. I mean, some of these things are certainly true in movies and in stage work as well. But I think more and more, because of the voracious appetite of television as a medium, writers depend on personality quirks of the actor to delineate character. And in the long run, my feeling as an actor is that there is no character. There's me, and I'm limited by what this character says and does according to the text.
Were you anxious to get back into TV after after One Day at a Time and after KRP?
I don't think I was ever anxious to get into TV. Even now, on an almost daily basis, there's a certain sense of, to quote a friend, joyful dread each morning. I like to work. I like the actor's work. I love doing it. But there is something about television, and particularly series production, that saps me of the will to live.
But other than that, it's great. Where does in the joyful dread, what's the dread part of the equation?
Well, most of television is so predictable. I mean, that's not limited to television either. I mean, a great many stage plays that we see now and a great many movies are so predictable in terms of the plot, in terms of the action, in terms of what little character revelation and delineation occurs. You know where they're going. You're not surprised. And I suppose, you know, I have these standards that are relatively impossible for me or anyone else to meet, in part because I can't define them. But I'm just, for the most part, disappointed when I look at television, particularly network television.
Do you find that television viewers' preconceptions of you vary according to who you're playing on TV? You know, when you were Johnny Fever, did they think of you as being someone who was always high and a real, you know, anti-authority kind of figure? Then when you were on One Day at a Time as someone who was going to marry Bonnie Franklin, and now as the teacher and head of the class, do people have a different idea of who you are based on who you're playing?
Absolutely. It's sometimes I think of it as sort of quaint, and sometimes it's terrifying. But many people's seeming inability to differentiate between a character that you're playing on television and who you really are. Of course, this flies in the face of what I was saying 8-10 minutes ago about in television, the actor sort of becomes the character, or some facet of the actor is exaggerated and becomes a key element of the character. But I also feel as though that's a problem that exists largely for those people and not for me.
But what are some of the different ways people have seen you? Different preconceptions people have had on you, had about you, depending on which role you've been playing at the time.
Well, it was very strange during the production of WKRP. We had extraordinary support from the radio broadcast industry, far more so than CBS TV. Thanks to radio, people knew that we were being bounced around the schedule like a ping pong ball for the entire 4 years. Radio people really followed the show and let their listeners know about it. And at the same time, radio people were very quick to talk about inaccuracies and inconsistencies in the studio setting of the show. And, you know, the only defense that one can offer is we're not doing a show about how radio works. We're doing a show about a group of people who happen to work together at a radio station. There is this poetic license that we're taking. But in terms of a specific character, ask me a question, I can babble forever. In terms of the character, yeah, people thought I was really loose, that I was always looking to get loaded, that I was some kind of party animal on my last legs, but I was going to go down, at full tilt boogie speed. hardly true. That had happened years before.
who did you pattern the disc jockey on who you played? Did you have an image in mind? I know, yeah. You were a disc jockey for a really brief period of time, around 6 months.
I was, and I welcome this opportunity to say this on radio. Repeatedly in talking with print interviewers, I would try to stress the fact that I had been a professional actor for several years prior to my brief and humiliating stint as a radio personality. I put quotes around that.
What was humiliating about it?
Well, I think when you're doing radio, you like to feel that people are listening and enjoying what they hear. And in my case, what little feedback occurred indicated to me that wasn't necessarily the case. But it was great fun, and I patterned Fever after my sense of myself as a disc jockey, but just with a little more, with a sufficient degree of success that was invisible to me. I mean, I thought, this guy is better than he thinks he is. He's really committed to doing a good job, but he's messed up any number of times along the way. But he's still good because of his commitment. Beyond that, there were a number of radio personalities who were good friends of mine in San Francisco in the 60s. And I think little bits and pieces of them would float through Fever from time to time, sort of little ghost visits. The late Tom Donahue, Big Daddy Tom Donahue, was sort of the father of progressive rock and roll radio in America, was a close friend. His wife, Rachel, is a terrific radio personality. There were any number of just little elements of different people would occur to me.
Did you have a hippie image when you first started acting?
Well, when I first started acting?
Yeah.
No, I was in the second grade. I probably started acting when I was about 3 years old. I was trying to act normal. But I became a professional actor in San Francisco with the Committee, an improvisational, a satirical, political improvisational review company in 1965. And I looked fairly normal. I wasn't inside. But I think I had just done a play, so I'd cut my hair. I looked sort of straight, kind of square, as we used to say. And that changed as the years went by, but I would come up with a role that would force me to cut my hair. Yeah, yes, I wore a lot of tie-dye and bright velvet English trousers and patchwork boots, and as often as not, my hair was longer than my neck.
You know what's funny? In the film Steelyard Blues, made in 1973, Donald Sutherland, Peter Boyle, John Savage, they play the misfits, they play the outsiders, and you play the suit, you play the establishment.
I have photographs of myself taken the day before I cut my hair to get the look of that character.
Oh.
And the film, incidentally, was made in 1971,
oh, okay.
I believe. 70 or 71, and released about a year later. But let's put it this way. I had hair that was close to between my shoulder blades and a long mustache, and I took all that off and discovered within the first week that none of my clothing worked any longer. When I was on the street, I can't really tell the story in the radio because it's not going to carry very well. But basically, people who normally would have, you know, winked or given me a high sign or something in a surreptitious manner.
Sure, passed you a joint or something.
Yeah, basically, many of us at that point in time walked with our eyes pretty much toward the ground for fear of tripping and meeting the ground suddenly face first. And when you saw somebody, you know, you kind of traveled up over the ankle bone, the knee bone, the thigh bone, up and checked out their face, and then it was just random head, eye, neck movements from there. And I would discover people coming up at about chest level, they were still smiling, and then they would see this haircut. It would get all different. There was a willful attempt to avert their eyes. And I got very quickly, probably within 2 or 3 days, that I appeared to be either on leave from boot camp or an incredibly crude undercover agent. And it was time to go buy some new clothes because this, you know, rock and roll drag didn't work anymore.
Well, speaking of undercover agents, didn't you once sell an ounce of grass to an undercover agent in the early 60s?
He begged me. He begged me endlessly. That's all I can say. The man was destitute. I knew he was an undercover agent, but just as a human being, and perhaps you had to be in San Francisco in 1963 to understand this, I wanted to help him.
Well,
now,
yeah.
It was 2 ounces, and in fact, at the preliminary hearing in San Francisco County Court, there was only 1 ounce offered in evidence. You draw your own conclusions.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Now, you know what they always say about how things are going to affect your later career. You got a 3-year sentence for this, which was suspended, but you had to serve 90 days in prison. Did this?
Yeah, that was before it was hip to be arrested for drugs.
Well, did this ever interfere with your acting career? Did you ever have to fill out an application there or anywhere else that said, "Have you ever been arrested"?
No, I filled out many of those. I served my probationary period. In fact, I had 3 years of probation, and at the end of 2 years, my probation officer recommended, and the court wisely saw fit, to terminate my probation since I'd clearly turned into an upstanding citizen and was doing my best to ridicule every holy institution in the Western world 6 nights a week on stage. But I was making a living, so I fit in somehow. Having your record expunged, at least in California, means that you can legally answer the question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? No. I think what it really means is that they cross out your name somewhere in the files, but it's still clear that you were once convicted of a felony, but that you can legally say you weren't. It's never been any real problem for me. The committee was not the sort of theater group that would look upon me with disdain for that sort of activity.
Right.
In fact, whether I did that or not was of little consequence to them.
Are you ever surprised when you wake up in the morning that you
yes.
have started?
Oh.
No, that's not what I meant. But that you who got started on the committee satirizing everything ended up a TV star.
Yeah, I. Yes, I've turned into one of my own targets. But many of us have been saying that for a long time. We became the people we used to satirize. It's terrifying to consider. And then on the other hand, you can say, well, of course, I was young when I did all that. It's all changed now. My values are different. I don't. Some of them are. Some of them aren't. If none of them changed, I would assume that you know I was the victim of some real. What do we want to say? Arrested development. And I don't think that's the case.
Howard Hessman speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1988. Hessman died Saturday. He was 81.